from Vision Australia Radio, it's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm the velvety voice of Vino, and my name's Michael Hintz. And with another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And it's hello from my producer. Well, I've got two producers this morning. Lloyd Shirley, the affable Lloyd, and the ebullient Tristan Hodson helping us out. Tristan's in training. Welcome, guys. Great to be with you again. And as I say each week, so many wines, so little time. Now, today and next week, we're going to meet the doyen of Rutherglen, master winemaker and esteemed wine show judge, the affable, talented David Morris from Morris of Rutherglen in Victoria's far northeast. David, welcome to Grapevine.
Yeah, morning, Michael. How are you going?
Very well, thank you. David became the fifth generation Morris to become a winemaker at the company's Mia Mia winery when he took over from his father, Mick, in 1993, I think, wasn't it, David?
Oh, that's right, yeah, yep. Late 93, yep. After vintage.
Yep, and I had the pleasure of celebrating David's 20th vintage at the helm late last year. The celebrations included, among other things, a splendid lunch in the cellar amid the barrels, sampling liquid gold in the form of a pre-phylloxera muscat, and we'll go into that a little later, and a vertical tasting of Morris Durif, which Morris first planted way back in 1920 and didn't start making until the 50s. That's a long gestation period. Is that correct, David?
Well, we definitely know we planted it in 1920.
Yeah.
And Mick came back from Roseworthy.
That was about 54, wasn't it?
54, that's right. That was his first vintage and he made Durif. Now, in the interim, we actually don't know what it was made for. I would actually second guess that when it was first planted, it was used as a dry red variety.
Yes.
But then when the war and the depression came along, a lot of turned to fortified, the higher strength alcohol than that.
Yes.
And that was basically the case through the 30s, 40s and stages of the, and until sort of Mick got back. So that's me second guessing. And also Durif, when it was brought into Australia by Di Castello.
Yes, and around about 1908 up in Rutherglen, wasn't it?
That's right, 1908, yes. And I don't know whether we planted Durif straight away then or not, but I know that whatever we planted in 1908 onwards for a couple of years, they got cleaned up by phylloxera. So that's why the 1920 was planted on rootstocks and we've still got that block going. But the Durif was recommended by Di Castello for dry red production. So I assume in the early years it may have been dry red, then went across to fortified, which it's a very good fortified, a variety for making fortified sort of tawny styles and vintage style.
Now, tell us a little bit about, well, how many vintages have you done, all told?
Oh, I suppose my first official vintage would have been about 78 or thereabouts. So, 37 years or something like that.
So then when you add those to your father, Mix, your total vintage between you would be getting up to the ton, wouldn't it?
It'd be getting up a fair bit. Anyway, even though my first few years were not here because, as Mick said, the place was not big enough for the two of us.
Yep.
So I was, working at other wineries for a while, getting some experience until he was ready to retire. But, he would have done a good 50 vintages anyway.
50 years. So you must be up into the mid-80s and still batting strong. I'm looking forward to when you, collectively break the ton, I suppose. There'll have to be another celebration.
Well, that's right. That's a good reason for it. I don't mind celebrations, but I'm looking forward to that one then.
Now, tell us a little bit about the history of Morris, its significance to Rutherglen, and then Rutherglen's significance to Victoria and Australian wine in that context. I know we've only got a short time, and that's a bit of a curly question, but there's a lot of history surrounding Rutherglen, isn't there?
There is, very much so. Just if you look at Rutherglen for a start, that was a very, very big viticultural area in Victoria back in the 1860s, 1870s.
Yeah, the mid-19th century, yes.
That's right. And even about 1890, I would have thought, 1880, 1890.
Yep.
Victoria was, Rutherglen was two-thirds of the Victorian industry.
And that's two-thirds in terms of size and production, is it?
Yes, that's right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And Victoria was actually two-thirds of the Australian industry.
So you're saying at one time there, in colonial times almost, Victoria was the dominant player in the wine industry.
That's for sure, yeah. So,
and Rutherglen was the driving force within that.
That's right. I think the Australian Wine Board had five members on, of which two had to come from Rutherglen. So that was the how representation was worked out.
Yep.
So that was, you know, when we were big. But what happened was, very much in the early days,
yes,
the wine was made in Rutherglen. It was taken to the port of Wagunya.
Yes.
Paddle ship down to Echuca,
yep,
and then put on the railway line down to Melbourne.
Yep.
And because the business was building up so big with exports back to the UK predominantly,
yes,
that they put a rail line into northeast Victoria.
Yes.
So hence we could then cart the wine down to Melbourne quicker.
Yep.
And the wine industry was making so much money that the Victorian government put a bounty on if people planted grapevines, they'd get money because they could see that it was a great industry.
Cash cow, yes.
The only thing is, whenever governments get involved, that's when it goes bad. And it was just, you know, too big a boom, too quick.
Yes.
Everyone started making wine where some were not qualified and there was a bit of ordinary wine made.
Yep.
And it tarnished the Australian reputation. So then I think there was a the government then had to put a spirit company in that bought the ordinary wine and distilled that.
Yes.
That's going back up until about 1900. And then, Phylloxera also wiped out the Rutherglen area as well in the early, 1900s to 1911, I think, was a pretty serious drought, and that more or less put the end of the Rutherglen industry. But the technology of planting on rootstocks or fumigating the soil were bandied around. Well, in our first effort at replanting, we fumigated the soil,
yes,
which does kill the phylloxera aphid off.
Yep.
But the only thing is it's still got the benefit of the ability to come back. And so it's not until planting on rootstocks that had a resistance to the phylloxera aphid that we're back into sort of full.
And where do those rootstocks come from? Were they from the States?
They are, American rootstocks, that's right.
Yeah. Well, look, a lot of this, for people wanting to explore the fascinating history of Morris and Rutherglen, of course, would be encapsulated in an excellent book written by David Dunstan called Morris of Rutherglen. I don't know how long ago David wrote that. It's called Morris of Rutherglen, Five Generations of Winemakers. Is that still available?
Yeah, there is some still from Cellador. He did the first one about 25, 30 years ago.
Yep, yep.
And then he updated it maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, I think.
Yep.
The updated version was done, and a bit of a new slant put on it. So he's done two books on the history of Morris over time.
Yes, yes. Well, that'd be handy for people wanting to a sense of not only Morris, but of the importance of Rutherglen.
It has got both.
And it was interesting back in those days, the railways were pretty efficient. Now the rail line through the northeast is a little less efficient, isn't it? I bet you guys up there wish you had a rail service you could get to Melbourne on time and quickly.
That's right.
The old infrastructure's gone backwards, isn't it?
It hasn't rained for a long time, but they're blaming bog holes. So
yes. Now, is it true, despite all the success at home and abroad, Morris wines have collectively won more gold medals, gongs, accolades, ribbons, you name it, acclamation generally, than I've had hot dinners, and believe you me, I've had a few hot dinners, folks. As a winemaker, do you still see yourself as only as good as your last vintage?
Very much so. You know, is
that what keeps you going? Because you've been doing it for a long while. How do you keep that, freshness and enthusiasm?
Yeah, well, I suppose you can't rest on your laurels. You can make a good wine one day, but if you don't keep doing the right thing in the vineyard and the right thing in the winery, all the following vintages may not be as strong. But it's always a challenge, but it's one of those sort of pleasurable challenges that you get a lot of satisfaction out of, and because you're making something that you can sit down with that hot dinner that you're talking about,
yes,
and enjoy it. And probably when you were talking about those hot dinners that you have, you're enjoying that with a good quality wine.
Absolutely, and after dinner too, with a good quality Muscat or Tokay or Port.
That's right. So hence, you can make a good wine on the bench in the winery and everything else like that. But you always put the acid test, what's it like with the meal as well. And that's the icing on the cake when you get the satisfaction right across the board.
I love the summer. I think it was the wine writer Philip White, way back in the early 90s, said, and I'll quote him, "Here under this roof, this bloke is the caretaker of one of the galaxy's rarest troves, a shed full of very old Muscat." And, of course, at that time he was talking about your dad, Mick. "The smell of the joint is as vivid as its pictures. Somewhere there amongst the musty, dusty aromas of ancient oak, hot iron, powdery gunmetal dirt, and a thousand tiny leaks, where the good oil drips and weeps, you've got a cornucopia of smells, all Australian. And the single absolute essence of this Larrikin Isle, circa 1859, which is when this temple opened." And, of course, he was talking about Morris Winery, wasn't he?
Well, it sounds very poetic and very romantic and everything else like that, but that, if you walk into the place, that probably is a true...
It's a
root reflection of the place. There's
A
lot of large casks there. They do weep a bit.
Yeah.
It is under an iron roof. And, as soon as you take visitors into the place, they go, "Oh, wow, smell it," and everything like that. I suppose I'm used to it, so you just sort of walk straight through. But, his words are a fair sort of reflection of what the winery's like.
I think they're brilliant. That's very Morris. And to me, that's evokes memories of how I remember Rutherglen. It wasn't only yourself. It was Chambers, Rosewood, Campbell's. There weren't the sophisticated, modern, technological, clinically pristine wineries that, some of the cool climate people boast. These were pretty basic sort of setups. And yet this bloody good wine came out of them.
Yeah, for making fortifieds in particular, you only need a tin shed. It doesn't have to be a beautiful steel structure. And there's a lot of large wooden barrels stored in there where you make your white table wine. That's probably in the shiny stainless steel tank.
But, yeah.
We've got those there.
Yeah.
And there's not much romanticism in those, but we've got plenty of barrels that people like wandering amongst.
And people love, to me, with about the wines, it's not only the wines, it's the company, the fun, and the stories and the people and places behind the wines that I think people find equally as fascinating and enjoyable as the wines, don't they?
They do. They like to touch and feel a little bit or see and experience. And if there's a good story to it, they really do appreciate it. It gives them sort of more relationship with the winery.
Yes, and of course, over the many years, you'd have built up many relationships and a lot of memories, I suppose, that keep coming back.
Oh, that's right. We've got a lot of loyal supporters that will visit us, and so you're always on for a chat, whether you're busy or not. You're on for a chat, and there's some great people that you meet in this industry.
So there's more to wine than just making the wine, isn't there? And there's talking about it and enjoying it in company, and that's where I think I can't recommend highly enough, and that people get out and visit cellar doors, because that's where you get a chance to talk to the winemaker, to see the vines, to see the earth, etc. Look, David, we're just about out of time for this week, so thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to chatting to you, continuing this conversation next week.
Yeah, that'll be great, Mike. I'll look forward to it.
Good, David. Hello, hello, hello. I'm Michael Hinson. You're listening to Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. Now, congratulations to Sanguine Estates' Mark Hunter. Things are bubbling along in Heathcote, where they celebrated this year's Shiraz Haven or Heaven Wine and Food Festival back on the 4th and 5th of October last. Some 45 of Heathcote's wine producers showcased some of the region's best Shiraz and other varieties in one place, namely the Heathcote Showgrounds, during the weekend. Around 200 Heathcote wines were available for free tasting and for sale by the glass and the bottle. Now, Heathcote Shiraz is one of Australia's most exciting modern wine styles. To appreciate any of the great wines of Australia, you must first understand where these wines came from and what's special about the sense of place, in this case, Heathcote, that allows or makes the wine so special. And congratulations to one Heathcote producer, namely, as I mentioned earlier, Sanguine Estate, and its winemaker Mark Hunter, on picking up a host of awards recently for their 2012 Dorsa Shiraz, which took out a five-star rating in the Winestate magazine's World's Greatest Shiraz and Shiraz Challenge, and in so doing equaled the iconic 2009 Penfolds Grange, which sells, the Grange, of course, sells for a hefty three-figure sum. I've got to say, the Dorsa Shiraz sells for a lot less. So it just shows you. It's not what you pay, it's more relates to what's in the quality of the bottle. The Sanguine Estate 2012 Dorsa Shiraz came in among the top 5% of over 503 Shiraz wines judged from Australia and around the world. It also won a gold medal at both this year's Boutique Wine Awards and was among Victoria's top 100 wines selected. Also, coming up next February is Sanguine Estates Music Festival from the 13th through to the 15th of February 2015, which is attracting more attention each year. It was launched back in 2012, and the festival, directed by Chris Howitt and Howard Penny, is now an annual event featuring, of course, some excellent wine and food, but also some equally good chamber music. Now, meanwhile, back up north in the Hunter Valley, the local wine industry, which each year attracts more than 2.2 million visitors to the Hunter Valley and generates an annual regional income of over 520 million, is being put under the microscope in a University of New South Wales study. The four-year $170,000 project is now underway, and it's examining the role the Hunter Valley has played in influencing the nation's drinkers to switch from beer to wine. So if we go back a little in history, this is what this is focusing on. It's focusing on how the Hunter Valley producers have changed Australian culture by helping create a taste for their wines. The Australian Bureau of Statistics reported last April that beer consumption in Australia has more than halved since its peak back in the mid-1970s, and was now at its lowest level since 1945-46. Beer's proportion of Australian alcohol consumption had fallen from 41%, while wine share has risen to 37%. The research team is headed by Chief Investigator Professor John Germoff and includes Newcastle University historian Dr. Julie McIntyre, who I've spoken to over the phone a few times, and Victoria's own Dr. David Dunstan of Monash University, and Professor James Simpson of the Carlos III University in Madrid. John Germoff is also Vice-Chancellor of the Faculty of Education Arts at Newcastle University. Julie McIntyre is a University of Newcastle lecturer in history and author of First Vintage, The Wine in Colonial New South Wales. And of course, many locally will know David Dunstan. He's not only a university lecturer and teacher, but he's author of numerous books on wine and has been a guest on this program, including last year's A Vision for Wine, A History of the Viticultural Society of Victoria. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, David was a grapevine guest earlier this year. James Simpson is a professor of economic history and has written extensively on the wine industry. The team study is going to be titled Vines, Wine and Identity, the Hunter Valley, New South Wales, and a Changing Australian Taste, and is enlisting the collaboration of such leading Hunter Valley wine identities as the affable Brian McGuigan, Jay Tulloch and Phil Ryan. The Hunter Valley wine industry numbers about 120 plus wineries and 230 wine-related businesses, and the research project will be the first historical sociological study of the region. Meanwhile, back closer to home, Victorian wine is set to receive a welcome export boost with the arrival of a Chinese trade mission early next year. The visit aims to promote Victorian wine, of course, on the world stage. It's to be the first ever super inbound wine mission, according to, I don't know who coined that phrase, whether it was Wine Australia, targeting senior wine buyers as part of a plan to significantly boost the state's food and beverage exports. It's part of the Victorian Government's Food to Asia Action Plan and will include visits to Victoria's wine regions to showcase the depth and diversity of our wine sector. And, of course, it'll incorporate business matching and wine masterclasses. The Victorian wine industry employs around about 11,500 people, including about 2,600 people in grape growing and winemaking, and generates more than $1 billion plus a year in revenue. Since December 2010, more than 60 companies from Victoria's wine industry have participated in these trade missions. Collectively, these organisations have reported projected increased export sales of more than $23 million for the 2 years following the relevant mission. Indigo Shire Mayor Bernard Gaffney said China was the number one export for Victorian wine, but not yet for the Rutherglen area, so Rutherglen must be in the Indigo Shire. So this coming trade mission will help put Rutherglen on the international wine and food map, according to Mayor Bernard Gaffney. Well, meanwhile, across the ditch in the land of the long white cloud, that's namely New Zealand, according to the country's Prime Minister John Key, the wine industry is a model of New Zealand's economy. The economy has changed in the wine industry from a fortress into a responsive, connected export industry, earning more than $1 billion a year, and, this is in New Zealand, is on track to double that. In just a relatively short period, 30 years, the Marlborough region and Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, has carved out a big name for itself, especially here in Australia, and has played a large part in putting New Zealand wine on the international map. This year, exports reached a record $1.33 billion, and the growth shows little evidence of slowing down. Now, this wine renaissance began, I think, around about 1985, when a group of influential people got their first taste of Marlborough wine in the form of a Cloudy Bay. Remember Cloudy Bay? Still there. Sauvignon Blanc. Something about it created a wave of excitement wine writers and consumers quickly spread the word, and, as they say, the rest is history. 30 years on, New Zealand wine is now exported to more than 100 countries worldwide, creating trade worth more than $1 billion. And still leading the charge are British consumers, with New Zealand sitting just ahead, or just behind, rather, France in terms of premium wine sales. More than 51 million litres of New Zealand wine, worth over $318 million, was shipped to the United Kingdom this year. That's a lot of wine. Obviously, Sauvignon Blanc will always dominate, but New Zealand is now producing a distinctive style of Chardonnay, and of course some of its Pinot Noir isn't far behind. Like Australia, New Zealand has gained a great reputation for consistently producing high-quality wines that's helped create such a strong market in the UK. And without a doubt, it was the 85 Cloudy Bay vintage that opened up the market for New Zealand wines in the UK. Now, the UK remains one of New Zealand's major markets, second in volume and value only to its export market here in Australia. Canada and the US are next, with the Netherlands rounding out the top five. This is of wines exported from New Zealand. Now, if you look at New Zealand and want to understand why it's done so well over the past 30 years, you really just need to look at the wine industry. Everything wrong in New Zealand was personified 30 or 40 years ago in the wine industry. It was at one time a fortress environment, closed, and there was little to no foreign investment. When the New Zealand Prime Minister, John Key, got married, he served cold duck to his wedding guests. Now, for those that don't know cold duck is the name of a sparkling wine that was coined, first made in the United States. During the early 1970s, the South Australian company Orlando Wines produced a sparkling red called cold duck. And between, I think, 71 and 74, there's also a number of trademark registrations, including cold turkey, cold gander, chicken and stork, and all that sort of thing. So there you go. Well, that's about your lot for now. My research material was sourced from my home library, winebiz.com, Morris of Rutherglen, the New Zealand Herald. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on all stations around Australia via the Community Radio Network, and cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.